interview with Robert Francis at his home on Siesta Key, Wednesday, April 6th, 1988. Mr. Francis was
Vice President for Operations from September 1981 through October of 1988.
All right. Question two. What year did you come to Stony Brook? You said 81.
81.
How old were you at the time?
I was 32.
32.
Right.
And from what institution and position did you come from?
I came from a regional university in Ohio called Wright State University. I was executive director of campus planning and operations there. That was my last position. I had a number of positions, including faculty member in the English department. I was an assistant dean of liberal arts. And I left there in 81 to come to the East Coast.
I see. Who was primarily responsible for your coming to Stony Brook?
Well, there's the efficient cause and the effective cause,
right.
I guess. President Marburger hired me. I would say that Jerry Schubel and the Three Village Inn recruited me.
Oh, really?
Because it's quite lovely,
yes.
Setting. And I first came in the late spring and early summer, and I really enjoyed the area.
Now, who was it that you succeeded?
Well, I had one of those wonderful experiences where I didn't succeed anyone, in the sense that the position of Vice President for Operations was a new one.
I see.
The responsibilities had formerly been split under the Vice President's then called Finance and Business, later Administration.
Mm-hmm.
That was Transportation and Security.
Who was in that?
And that was Carl Haynes, at that time, was then called Vice President for Finance and Business. And then there had previously been an Executive Vice President, and under him an Assistant Executive Vice President who was in charge of the physical plants.
Who was that?
The Assistant Executive Vice President was Mitch Gerstel.
I see.
And the Executive Vice President at the time was Alec Pond.
Alec Pond. Was he there at the time that you were hired?
He had stepped down from the position and had gone back to a faculty
position.
This was prior to his going to Rutgers.
I see. And then you were interviewed by Dr. Marburger and anybody else?
Well, Jerry Schubel headed the search committee, which consisted of, I think, probably about 15 people. And I recall a number of the names, Ron Laval, Dick Brown, the union people were on the search committee as well.
By union, you mean the student union?
The classified and faculty unions. There was a student on the search committee from the student government,
mm-hmm.
and a widely represented group.
I see. Okay. Why did you come? This is question six. Why did you come? What factors were important in your decision?
Well, a number of the things were personal and a number of the things were professional. I had finished my doctorate that year.
Where?
At Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. I had been at Wright State for 10 years at that point in a variety of positions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was programmatically similar in the sense that it had a medical school, not a hospital, but an ambulatory care facility, and this roughly the same size student body, a smaller physical plant. And I wanted to see what else was out there in the world of education that I might do that would provide a new challenge. And Stony Brook was bigger,
mm-hmm.
and it was in New York, and the East Coast appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I later found out about the academic eminence, but at the time that I looked at it, it was a real stepping stone for me in title and size.
In your field?
In my field.
In your particular field, right.
Which for for better or worse, as you go through these careers, you end up in a line of work, and so I suppose my line of work is service, support service management.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Seven, what was your understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook? How much did you know about it, obviously?
Well, I learned fairly early on that the idea was to create a Berkeley of the East. The Rockefeller vision was to have a university on Long Island that would move the then science teachers' college at Oyster Bay, the campus at Oyster Bay, into the first ranks of universities, would be a full-range university with all programs and have a graduate and research program of top rank,
all right,
competitive in the nation.
Do you have any impressions of Stony Brook when you got there?
Well, I can tell you what Roxanne, my wife, said when she first saw it and wondered whether or not it were for sale, because really it looked pretty rough.
Mm-hmm.
Physically it looked pretty rough, and that was what I was
rough?
Being...
What do you mean?
Oh, the grass wasn't mowed and the windows were broken out and
yeah,
and so on. And there were, at the very time I came in, they were just coming off of a month month-long electrical problem due to a catastrophic failure of a power supply. So I thought, gee, this is just the set of opportunities I was looking for. There's lots here to do, and it'd be exciting to try to solve these problems and work with people to meet their needs. So it, unlike Wright State, which I found out very quickly was kind of an ideal place where there were very few plant problems and very little problem with money. And Ohio is a little bit like Florida in that it's a state with comparatively no bureaucracy.
No, in other words, each individual institution is its own boss, doesn't have to go through a central...
Each individual institution in Ohio is established in statute. It's not constitutionally based, but each university in the Ohio system is separately established in statute, and the boards of trustees of each of the 13 schools in Ohio is empowered to transact all of its own business as an independent governing board, unlike New York.
Decentralized authority.
Yes.
Going along with responsibility.
Well, the accountability was certainly there, too.
Okay. And what about the people?
Well, I had anticipations about what I would find in the genus New Yorker, and I think they were all fairly accurate. I hadn't overblown the myth of the New Yorker. And I liked the New York pace, and I liked the New York style, and I liked New York people there. You know, they're just a little more of almost everything than Midwesterners are.
And, oh.
Yeah. A little, the pace is quicker. The people seem to have a higher level of energy. And certainly was true at Stony Brook. You could just walk around and it just felt energy intensive. And so when I would go out to the dormitories at midnight to meet with the student ledges, as they're called, the student legislatures, the governing body of each dormitory, the intensity was certainly there.
Midnight, huh?
Well, nothing starts before midnight at Stony Brook. I mean, occasionally you could get a meeting at 11.
I see.
But not too many people would turn out that early. If you met, and this is in the early days, this is 81 and 82, and I remember Fred Preston and I, together and then separately, had 2, 3, and even more nights a week where we would be out in the dormitories, and the meetings would always start somewhere between, say, 11 and midnight, and we'd get over maybe around 2, and then we would go home and sleep till about 7 and get up and do it again. So the energy was definitely there.
Preston was, what was his specific title?
Vice President for Student Affairs.
Student Affairs.
And he came at the same time. I think he came a month before I did.
I see. Okay. What about the top leadership?
Well, I was very impressed by my boss-to-be, because it was genuinely nice person, and I like to work for nice people. I had a vision and articulated the vision. That's important.
This is Jack.
Right. And always gracious and enjoyable to be around, even when dealing with difficult issues. There was a dignity and a sense of the importance of people in whatever we did.
Let's see. Dick Schmidt had left. Did you ever have anything to do with him?
I didn't meet him. I think he left in the summer of 80.
80?
As President Marburger arrived.
Right.
And then I didn't arrive until the summer of 81. So I didn't meet him. I had a chance to meet John Toll, but I didn't have a chance to meet Dick Schmidt.
I see. Okay.
All right, now let's see. Nine. What events, what persons, what experiences stand out in your mind?
I suppose I'll meld all three together. I think dormitory life, which may be an oxymoron, but the dormitory life that I saw was very prominent in the sense that there we had a community with 7,200 people. It's a small city, very homogeneous in terms of the age of the people, their intellectual capacity. It was not homogeneous in a racial or ethnic sense. There was a very cosmopolitan mixture in that regard. But otherwise, intellectually, the community was pretty homogeneous. And of course, people at that particular time in life have very high expectations. And the higher their intellectual capabilities, generally the higher their expectations. So a fairly demanding group. And I will never forget going out to the dormitories and meeting with people in these impassioned meetings until late in the morning. I will always remember the incredible contrasts, for instance, going up to meet distinguished professors, Jan Kott, I think is one that stands out, where you have an internationally prominent humanitarian who had an interior 110 square foot office on a corridor with no windows, so you would get that kind of thing. You would have
that was in the library.
That was in the library,
yes.
Or prominent laboratories in the biological sciences building, where research on the cutting edge was going on, and the cultures were dying because we couldn't keep the building air conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
It had a remarkable study in contrast.
Yeah.
To have the best and the brightest in not very attractive physical surroundings is the kind of an anomaly.
All right, you were talking about students dealing in an impassioned way with their problems. What were some of the problems that you first came across? What were they impassioned about?
Well, their grass wasn't mowed, and their rooms weren't clean, and the morning after the night before, the entire dormitory would be filled with a very strong stench of beer, so overpoweringly cloying the nostrils with this post-party smell.
Weekends or any night?
Thursday nights and weekends particularly, but not just Thursday nights and weekends. And then otherwise, just shabby conditions. Winters without properly functioning heating conditions, and of course dormitories aren't air conditioned, so that wasn't even a matter of importance. But I've studied the photographs of Jacob Riis because I like pictures of the lower New York from the 1880s, and he studied social conditions in the Bowery, and they're certainly not related. I mean, Stony Brook is not and never will be the Bowery, but I think on a comparative level to the people who lived in the dormitories, that's the way they felt.
Did the students themselves, from their own background, tend to create some of these conditions?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Part of it might be owing to their background from the metropolitan area. They were brought up in the metropolitan area and bring that perspective on physical arrangements to the campus. A lot of damage was, is, and probably will continue to be done at Stony Brook by students. Now, students do a lot of damage at other institutions, and I find that in public schools, students also do damage, but not quite on the scale that I saw at Stony Brook. Yes, certainly. And this, nowhere have I found more well-developed this desire not to be dominated by any authority than I found in the dormitory at Stony Brook. We are independent, we are free, stay out of our buildings, but why do they look this way?
Right.
So I think that there certainly there was a very strong responsibility on the part of the students for the conditions, but not completely.
Were they willing to assume any of the responsibility? Did they face it?
I didn't detect in very many of them a willingness to be responsible, but that's difficult when you're in a room with 300 other students to raise your hand and say, well, I don't agree with the other 299 of you. So, at least in the public forums, there wasn't a willingness to compromise in that regard. As the years passed, more of that spirit did emerge, that we share these problems. In the first two or three years, they were the administration's problems, not the student's problems.
You were able to get some cooperation later on from the students?
I think that there's some, in terms of who got the cooperation as time went by, I would say that the president in particular got more cooperation as time went by, and I think Fred Preston also earned considerably more cooperation as time went by from the student government. I'm not sure that I had the same experience in the sense that in my first 3 years, the constant battle was getting rid of and reducing dormitory cooking, and I was the agent for a series of price increases in the dormitory cooking program that took them from $50 a term to about $200 a term in the space of 4 years. And I came in...
for kitchen privileges.
Right, to cook in the rooms. I came in to face all the heating problems, and even though I believe very substantial progress was made to restore the basic mechanical systems, the simple point is that over a period of years, you start to inherit part of the problem and become identified with it. Rather than being the solution anymore, you are identified as part of the problem. So I think that my ability to have impact probably diminished in the last year and a half to the last 2 years I was there. And I think that particularly the the well-publicized closet fire in the lecture center in October of 86 was a point at which my ability to have a positive influence started to decline, because I came under a lot of pressure for my positions at that time.
Okay.
I didn't mention Sunwood, by the way, which should always be brought up. It's one of the things that I saw when I came, and it was in dilapidated condition when I came. And I want to give as much credit as can be given to Ann Forkin and for her role in building up the business there and enabling us to make progress to restore the house. And it was really, at the time of the fire, almost all the way back to being a beautiful property. And of course that was a very sad thing, and I think the burning of Sunwood took a lot out of anybody who was in a position of responsibility there at the time.
Let's stay with Sunwood for a minute. My memory is that it was a home that had been built about 1918, and that when we took it over from Mr. Morville, it was in 57 or 58 that it was given, and the wiring and the plumbing were out of date, outmoded. Mr. Melville had given, I think, something like $25,000 to be used for rehabilitation. That didn't last very long. And it was the only place that had any charm and that could be used to attract candidates. We used it for that purpose. And yet we could not get from the central office a recognition that it was a sufficiently important asset to be cared for in the way it was needed.
It's one of the many tragedies, and I think it's a greater tragedy to the people at the campus than it was to people 220 miles away.
Yeah.
But that's true, the recognition was not given. And a home like that, an estate like that, is certainly not inexpensive to rehabilitate. I would say that in the 5 years I was there, including the recycled funds from Ann Forkin and the funds that I managed to put in from my budgets, I'll bet we put over $100,000 into the house. But still, even after $100,000, we had only started to make the progress that we wanted to see. More was required. And that is a real shame. I mean, whatever the disadvantages of the house were in terms of its fine point, the size and the arrangement of the rooms and so forth, you're absolutely right. It had a charm and a grace that is important in academic life that the buildings on the campus, for the most part, don't have.
Okay.
And so we lost a physical expression of charm and grace that could never be restored.
That's right. We couldn't get people from the central office to appreciate the value of it the way we did. As far as you were concerned, what expectations did you have when you came? How long did you expect to be there?
did you understand pretty well what the problems were?
Well, I came when I was 32.
Yes.
Although I had already completed a career in this field, so mm-hmm. I wasn't new to the field. Mm-hmm. And I was full of the feeling that I could come and make a difference. And I believe that. And of course, even now at the ripe old age of 39, I still feel exactly the same way, that I can go and make a difference. Mm-hmm. And the things that, in retrospect, appear to have been overwhelming, didn't appear to be overwhelming at the time. They just seemed like detours that you had to get around. The bureaucracy, for example, is a detour that you simply have to...
Can you go into that specifically?
Sure.
Yeah.
First of all, I think it's important to distinguish bureaucrats from the bureaucracy. I'm a bureaucrat in the Weberian sense, and I don't regard that as being a pejorative term. It's an expression for working in an institution that's complex. And all of the people that you meet at various levels of state government and otherwise are ordinarily genuinely interested in helping you solve your problems. And this is true of all the central administrators, and I'm very fond of many of them, had an excellent working relationship with them. And that same thing goes for people in the Division of the Budget and the Dormitory Authority and every other place.
Stop there. Can you mention some of the individuals with whom you dealt?
Sure. Starting with the Director of Engineering Services, there's Dick Murray. He was our campus coordinator for physical facilities. Wonderful man. Then two people who are really prominent in my career are Lindo Signorelli, Associate Vice Chancellor for Capital Facilities, and Irv Friedman, the Vice Chancellor for Capital Facilities. My career overlapped Oscar Lanford's career only by a few months, and I only met him a few times.
I see.
And then on the other side in the construction fund, Mort Gassman and Elwin Stevens, Steve as he's known, wonderful guys, and all of them really dedicated to building the entire state university, and also dedicated to Stony Brook, ordinarily pretty clear about what they perceived as the problems, and I didn't always agree with their perceptions of the problems, but they still had a genuine interest in helping. But moving to the more abstract, the bureaucracy, that's a very grinding experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And working in New York can, over time, incapacitate you. And I think probably other people have expressed similar thoughts.
Were you there long enough to see any change produced by the Friday Commission, the one that Wharton appointed to see if it couldn't generate some legislative changes?
Self-sufficiency. The whole process of self-sufficiency, or as I used to refer to it, insufficiency.
Yeah.
With every initiative, there's a price. You pay for what you get. That's from The Sun Also Rises, I think. That's one of my favorite passages. But the point is that, and this comes from my perspective of having been an administrator all my career now in times of shrinking resource bases. So I've been cutting all my life. I've never had a chance to build things up. I have always been cutting. And the self-sufficiency movement had a price in it, which was the extraction of resource at the other end. The 83-84 year was a bad budget year where we lost a lot of money and a lot of resources. The Friday Commission came after that for roughly a year.
So you lost the money because it was not given to you, is that right?
Right.
Not because you didn't spend it.
Oh, no, we never lost money that we didn't spend. Yep. We always lost money that was taken away from us.
I see.
The campus has had an excellent record of spending its money.
Uh-huh.
And I think if you look at the financial records, you'll find that one of the more remarkable studies in spending the budget. But each year,
The Division of Budget is remarkably clever in devising new ways of extracting money from you in ways that are very difficult for legislators and the public to understand. And therefore, they're quite successful.
Did the Division of the Budget deal directly with Stony Brook, or did it deal through the central office?
Well, the formal chain is always through the central office.
Right.
But of course, informally, we had extensive contacts with the people in budget, and that could almost be said to be on a day-to-day basis.
How much help did you get from your central office with the budget?
Well, I think that the prevailing campus mood was that we needed a lot more help than we got.
And you got. Why?
Yeah.
Why didn't they give it to you? Weren't they able to? Didn't they understand what the needs were?
Well,
or weren't they?
To give the benefit of the doubt, where it may not be entirely justified, then I think they understood the needs. Mm-hmm. It may be arguable that it's not possible for a person who doesn't have the same kind of academic background to understand the needs of a campus like Stony Brook. But let's give them that argument, but then look at their position, where you have this campus, Stony Brook, which looks to the other 31 or 63, depending on how you count them, campuses in the system are always...